since April of 1985. This is the DX Audio Service. National Radio
Club. Welcome to the National Radio Club's DX Audio Service for March 2010. This is issue number 300. If you'd like to write to us at the DX Audio Service, the address is 706 McKenzie Drive, spelled M-A-C-K-E-N-Z-I-E, Lima, Ohio, 45805-1835. Email is sales, S-A-L-E-S, at nrcdxas.org. A yearly subscription to the DX Audio Service for U.S.-Canadian members is $28. Tapes are sent via first-class mail, and you keep your cassettes. To subscribe or renew, make a check payable to the National Radio Club Incorporated and send them to me at the address that is mentioned, or you can log on to our website at www.nrcdxas.org and sign up using our PayPal credit card system. Or if you're on the internet, you can sign up to EDXN and get your DX Audio Service in MP3 format. A subscription to EDXN is only $15. Just point your browser to www.e-dxn.com and subscribe online with the PayPal credit card system. You must be able to download and navigate a website to use this service. Well, let's use the services of Mr. Bill Hale. He's got all the information that we need to know. Here's Bill with the AM Switch.
Thanks again, Fred, and welcome everyone to AM Switch for the DX Audio Service for March 2010. Call letter changes, 690 WSPZ Birmingham, Alabama is now WJOX. 780 WPTN in Cookeville, Tennessee has changed calls to WHUB. 970 in Spring City, Tennessee, the former WXQK is now WRHA. 1050 on the dial in Silver Spring, Maryland, the old WZAA is now WTOP. 1340 KPTR Cathedral City, California has made the switch to KWXY. 1350 WNNG Warner Robins, Georgia, they now ID as WRWR. 1400 WHUB Cookeville, Tennessee is now known as WPTN. 1480 WCIN in Cincinnati, Ohio, their new call is WDJO. And the final call letter change this month, 1490 WFFX, East St. Louis, Illinois, their new call is WQQX. Stations on the air now with changed facilities, 1100 KWWN in Las Vegas, Nevada, they're now on with U4, 22,000 watts during the day, 2,000 watts at night, increasing the day power by 10%. Don't forget that U4, two different patterns day and night. 1130 KTRP, Mount Agel, Oregon. This new station has been heard testing. Their facilities are U4, 25,000 watts during the day, 490 watts at night from three towers. The day pattern is balloon-shaped headed northeast, while the night pattern is lake-shaped headed southwest. Their projected sign-on date is late March or early April. 1210 KTBK, Auburn Federal Way, Washington. The station is licensed for U4, 27,500 watts daytime, 10,000 watts at night from two transmitter sites. KTBK has been granted an auxiliary license of U4, 27,500 watts days, 227 watts at night, and is now operating with those facilities. When applying for this change in night power, they stated, the licensed nighttime transmitter site is located on the banks of the Green River east of Auburn. For the past 47 years, this area of King County has been protected from flooding by the Howard Hanson Dam. The Army Corps of Engineers has discovered a leak in the dam and has announced that until repairs can be made, the capacity of the dam to contain runoff will be limited. Flooding in the valley below, where the KTBK nighttime transmitter site is located, is likely to occur. Repairs to the dam are projected to take as long as 5 years to complete, so they requested authority to operate the presently authorized daytime facilities during nighttime hours should the licensed nighttime transmitter site flood. So what that means is they are now operating U4, 27,500 watts days, 227 watts at night, with two different patterns. So that's quite a kick down from their 10 kilowatts nighttime. 1570 WTLK, Taylorsville, North Carolina. Their construction permit for 900 watts days, 198 watts at night, U1, that's non-directional all hours, is now on. They moved to a new transmitter site of co-owned WACB860. Since the WACB tower is approximately 1.5 times the height of their old tower, WTLK was forced to reduce the power levels from the former 1,000 watts daytime, 244 watts at night, in order to achieve the same coverage. Some actions over the past 30 days. 540 WLIE Islip, New York. Licensed for U4, 2,500 days, 220 watts at night. WLIE had a CP for U4, 10,000 watts days, 250 watts at night. They filed for and now have received a change to the CP. This time, they're reverting back to the old facilities at night of 220 watts directional. So their new facilities will be U4, 10,000 watts during the day, 220 watts at night. 610 CHNC, New Carlisle, Quebec. They've been granted their application to continue simulcasting with their new FM until 1 November. Seems they haven't got the coverage that they had on the AM on the FM station, so they have to tweak that a little bit. The same authority has been granted to CHGM 1150 in Gaspé, Quebec. Once again, their new FM is having a hard time achieving the coverage of the AM, so they're going to stay on with the AM until 1 November. 1060 WBIX, Natick, Massachusetts. CP has been granted for 50,000 watts during the day, 2,500 watts at night, U4, increasing the daytime power. Now using all five of their towers, formerly two of the five, the new daytime pattern will direct all of the signal in a balloon-shaped plot due east, as opposed to the old pattern, which was directed to the northeast. 1110 KDIS, Pasadena, California. Licensed for U4, 50,000 watts during the day, 12,500 at night. KDIS engineers discovered that the antenna system, which is built on ground that is a landfill and as a result has been settling, has caused the transmission and sample lines to deteriorate. KDIS has been issued a special temporary authority for 12,500 watts days, 5,000 watts at night, non-directional, while new transmission lines are connected and necessary modifications are made to the phaser and tuning units. No telling how long that might take, but since their patterns usually reflect their power out to the west over the ocean, you guys living east of Los Angeles area might try for them. 1140 KLTK, Centerton, Arkansas. CP has been granted for 5,000 watts daytime only, non-directional. 1270 KZNS, Salt Lake City, Utah. A CP has been granted for U4, 50,000 watts days, 670 watts at night, co-locating with the array of KTKK 630. 1280 WTMY, Sarasota, Florida. Licensed for U4, 500 watts daytime, 340 watts at night. WTMY has been granted a special temporary authority for U1, that's non-directional day and night, 100 watts during the day, 85 watts at night, diplexing into the tower of WSDV 1450 as WTMY lost the lease of their transmitter site. 1440 WDXQ, Cochrane, Georgia. They've been granted a CP for 940 watts days, 48 watts at night, all non-directional, and to reduce their antenna from 310 to 190 feet. 1510 KGA, Spokane, Washington. Licensed for U4, 50,000 watts day and night, KGA has a CP for U4, 50,000 watts days, 15,000 watts at night, and an STA for U5, 50,000 watts during the day, 12,500 watts at night. U5, that's directional daytime only, while work continues on the new facilities of co-channel KPIG Piedmont, California. While using the 12,500 watts non-directional at night, KGA received interference complaints from co-channel KCKK Littleton, Colorado. To alleviate this interference, KGA has been granted an STA for U4, 50,000 watts days, 12,500 watts at night, using the day pattern at night until the KPIG facilities are approved and on the air. Then KGA will go to U4, 50,000 watts days, 15,000 watts at night. 1550 KESJ, St. Joseph, Missouri, licensed for U2, that's directional at night only, 5,000 watts days, 5,000 watts at night, KESJ has been granted a special temporary authority to operate with variances in the nighttime directional array in order to replace cables and associated hardware. The normal nighttime pattern directs the signal north-northwest, so possible DX reception may be experienced to the east and south until repairs and final proofs of performance adjustments are completed. 1560 WTOD, Toledo, Ohio. The license for WTOD and W264AK 100.7 has been transferred from Cumulus to Calvary Chapel of Twin Falls, Incorporated, and changed to non-commercial status. And finally, 1600 KAHZ, Pomona, California. They're licensed for U2, 5,000 watts day and night. They applied for U4, 10,000 watts days, 20,000 watts at night. But after discovering a fault in the buried cable to the tower enabling the night directional pattern, KAHZ is now operating under a special temporary authority of 5,000 watts days, 1,250 watts at night, non-directional, until the transmission line can be repaired and retuning of the night signal is completed. No new stations have been granted this past 30 days. Our next category is applications, and we only have two to report this month. 830 CKKY, Wainwright, Alberta. They've reapplied to the CRTC to move to 101.9 megahertz with 57 kilowatts at 136 meters. Their previous application to move to FM was rejected by the CRTC on the basis that their owner, NewCap, would have three FM stations in the same market due to signal overlap with their Lloydminster station, CKSA-FM. In this application, there's a deep null toward Lloydminster to get around the problem. If this application is approved, it will then allow CFCW 790 Camrose, Alberta to go ahead with their planned move to 840. And 1450 CHOR Summerlin, British Columbia. They've applied to move to 98.5 megahertz with 100 watts at 348 meters as they will be evicted from their present transmitter site at the end of the year. They propose continuing with their adult contemporary format. Well, each month our list of AM stations being carried on FM has grown, and this month is no exception. We have several more for you. 560 WOOF Dothan, Alabama is now carried on W261AT, 100.1 on the dial, Dothan, Alabama. 590 WROW Albany, New York, they're carried on WKLI FM, 100.9 in Albany. 630 KIDD Salinas, California. They're on KYZZ 97.9 in Salinas. 690 WJOX Birmingham, Alabama. They're carried on WJOX FM 94.5. 690 KPET La Mesa, Texas. They're on K286AO 105.1 in La Mesa. 770 KCHU Valdez, Alaska. They can be heard if you're in the area on KXKM 89.7 in McCarthy. 950 KNFT Reserve, New Mexico. They're on KZXQ 104.5 in Reserve. 960 WELI, New Haven, Connecticut. They're carried on WKCI FM HD3. 101.3 in Hamden, Connecticut. 1050 WZAA Silver Spring, Maryland. WTOP FM 103.5 in Washington carries that signal. 1230 WXCO Wausau, Wisconsin. They're on WDTX 100.5 in Rothschild. 1260 KFFF Boone, Iowa. They're on their sister station, KFFF 99.3. 1310 KZRG, Joplin, Missouri. They're translated on K275BD 102.9. 1350 WRWR, Cochrane, Georgia. They're on their FM station with the same calls, 107.5 in Cochrane. 1360 WTAQ, Green Bay, Wisconsin. They're on WTAQ-FM 97.5, licensed to Glenmore, Wisconsin. And finally, 1580 WWDN, Danville, Virginia. They're on W283BN 104.5 in Denville. License cancellations, calls deleted, one this month, 1320 WHHO, Hornell, New York. Two dismissals to report 1480 CJOY, Guelph, Ontario. The CRTC has denied the application of CJOY to move to 95.7 MHz. The agency cited that if granted, the owner, which is Chorus, would exceed the two-station limit for this small market. And 1540 KMPC, Los Angeles, California, their construction permit for U4, 50,000 watts during the day, 44,000 watts at night, has been dismissed. They remain 50,000 watts during the day and 37,000 at night. Well, some items from here and there returning to the airwaves this past month. KEOR 1120 Catoosa, Alabama with Urban Hits. KAGO 1150 Klamath Falls, Oregon with Talk Format. WKFL 1170 Bushnell, Florida with Sports. WVMC 1360 Mount Carmel, Illinois with Adult Contemporary. KPTO Pocatello, Idaho on 1440, WGCK 1480 Neon, Kentucky, and WWDN 1580 Danville, Virginia with a classic hits format. However, the following stations have gone silent: WNAK 730 Nanticoke, Pennsylvania, WJNZ 1140 Kentwood, Michigan, WPLX 1180 Terrell, Arkansas, KQMG 1220 Independence, Iowa, WYXC 1270 Cartersville, Georgia, KBJM 1400 Lemon, South Dakota. They were reported back on, but at our deadline, there's no indication of that in the FCC website. WIGG 1420 is off. They're in Wiggins, Mississippi. WCDL 1440 Carbondale, Pennsylvania reported off. Also with their plates at zero, WKDG 1540 Sumaton, Alabama, and KGBC 1540 Galveston, Texas is off again. And also this entire Disney-owned group pending the sale of each station. WRJR 1010 in Portsmouth, Virginia, KALY 1240 Los Ranchos de Albuquerque, New Mexico, WCOG 1320 Greensboro, North Carolina, KMUS 1380 Sperry, Oklahoma, WMNE 1600 Riviera Beach, Florida, and WHKT 1650 Portsmouth, Virginia. Fines to report: a fine of $17,500 has been assessed to KRAL 1240 Rawlins, Wyoming, along with their FM station, for one, failing to ensure the operational readiness of their emergency alert system, two, for failing to maintain a complete public inspection file, and three, for failing to operate station WHB 734, which is a studio-to-transmitter link, from its licensed location. And here's a switch. The FCC has canceled a $7,000 fine against KHPP 1160 Waukon, Iowa, and replaced it with a penalty of $187.50. The fines had been proposed for failure to file for license renewal in 2004 and continuing to broadcast after the old licenses had expired in 2005. But it seems the application was filed on time. They just didn't include the proper fee. So the FCC has assessed a penalty of $187.50, which amounts to 25% of the original filing fee. Well, news item number one this month, the CRTC has approved the application by the owner of CISL 650 in Richmond, British Columbia, to broadcast Russian language programming during the Vancouver Olympics. CISL is devoting no more than 20% of each broadcast week to Russian language programming for the period of February 10th to 28th. So if you happen to be tuning by 650 and you heard some Russian, no, it wasn't long distance DX. It was probably Richmond, British Columbia. Depending on what part of the country you're in, it may have been DX. News item number two, also from Canada. Chorus Entertainment has shut down two Canadian powerhouse stations, CINF 690 and CINW 940, both Montreal. They said they will return the licenses to the CRTC. The plug was pulled at both stations at 7 p.m. local time, January 29th. The Info 690 Montreal Newsroom, known as Chorus Nouvelle, will continue its activities as part of 98.5 FM Montreal. AM 940, formerly CFCF, was Canada's first regularly operated commercial radio station, first signing on in 1919. Well, that's about it this month. My thanks go out to Sean Axelrod, Wheeler Conover, Wayne Heinen, Dean McIntyre, Tim Noonan, news from Steve Ponder, relayed via Wayne Heinen, Dave Schmidt, and RadioInfo.com. We'll see you all next month with another edition of AM Switch.
Thanks, Bill. You know, it seems like every time you turn around, there's somebody with their hand in your pocket trying to leverage out a few dollars. Well, that's what's happening to radio right now. The Performance Rights Act is a proposed bill that would essentially bail out the record industry, requiring radio stations to pay royalty fees similar to a tax when music is played on the air. The breakdown is going to be like this. Record labels would receive 50%, artists 43%, musicians and background singers an additional 5%. Who would be hit the hardest? Small and independent radio stations such as college radio stations. An annual flat rate would be calculated according to the radio station's revenue, an estimated $500 a year for a small station, $5,000 for a medium station, and much more for larger stations. And many say that's big money. It's adding up year after year that they just don't have. Well, it seems like the Ohio Association of Broadcasters is fighting back with a PSA that sounds like this.
So, here's a new idea. What this country needs right now is a new bailout, right? Let's put a new tax on something and then send money to people who don't really need it. That'll work. This time, they want to put a new tax on every song played on the radio. And who gets a pile of money? Hundreds of millions of dollars? Giant record companies, most of which are in foreign countries. We'll pay all the money, and they'll keep gobs of it. Great. It's a bad idea. It could bankrupt local radio stations. But like a lot of bad ideas, it will happen unless we tell our members of Congress to stop it. Join us. Go to www.noperformancetax.org. That's noperformancetax.org. Tell your members of Congress to stop the radio performance tax. That's why the National Association of Broadcasters and this radio station are airing this message. Stop the radio tax.
St. Cloud State University student-run radio gets approximately $14,000 a year from student government funding. Their total operations are nearly $2,000 more, roughly $16,000 total, an amount that they need to make up in advertising and raise money. The new $500 imposed tax would represent 25% of what they need just to break even. This bill has been introduced and passed by committees. Now the House and Senate needs to vote, along with the president's pen. So if you like free radio, you might want to get a hold of your legislators and tell them to stop the performance tax.
A few months ago, listeners to the Musings line asked for a story on time tones and clocks as used in radio. Last month, as we began to investigate this whole area of time signals, we began the story of the granddaddy of all timekeepers, the National Bureau of Standards, or NBS, and the launch of WWV. Today we finish that tale, taking a look at two other grandfather clocks, if you will, WWVB in Colorado and WWVH in Hawaii, reading and excerpting from the official release of the Bureau. WWVH began operation on November 22, 1948, at Kihei on the island of Maui in the then territory of Hawaii. Hawaii was not granted statehood until 1959. A meeting of the International Telecommunications Union, ITU, held in 1947, resulted in agreements that standard frequency stations would be allocated at 2.5, 5, 10, 15, 20, and 25 megahertz, frequencies already used by WWV. NBS then made the decision to build WWVH as a second standard frequency station to be operated simultaneously with WWV. The second station would increase the service coverage area, would allow NBS to determine the amount of accuracy obtainable in synchronizing two or more standard frequency stations, and would also allow NBS to develop methods for operating separate stations on the same frequency. The Hawaii location was chosen to maximize the coverage area and to prevent interference to existing users of WWV services. The original WWVH station broadcast a signal of about 1 kilowatt on 5, 10, and 15 megahertz. The station was turned off twice daily at 0700 and 1900 GMT to permit reception of WWV in Hawaii to help calibrate the WWVH broadcast. WWVH radiated output power on 5, 10, and 15 megahertz was 2 kilowatts, and as it does today, the program schedule of WWVH closely followed the format of WWV. However, voice announcements of time were not added to the WWVH broadcasts until July 1964, some 14 years after they first appeared on WWV. The original voice announcements broadcast Hawaiian Standard Time. A 1 kilowatt, 2.5 megahertz broadcast began in 1965. The original WWVH station site near the Hawaiian coast was being constantly threatened by an eroding shoreline, and much of the station's equipment and property were being damaged. By 1965, the ocean was within a few meters of both the main building and the 15 megahertz antenna, and it was obviously necessary to move WWVH to a new location. A congressional appropriation in June 1968 was used to fund the move and the new station. On July 1, 1971, they began broadcasting from the current location, a 30-acre site on the island of Kauai, Hawaii. This site is located on a United States naval base called the Pacific Missile Range Facility. Many changes took place when the station moved to Kauai. The power was increased to 10 kilowatts on 5, 10, and 15 megahertz, and 2.5 kilowatts on 2.5 megahertz, increased to 5 kilowatts shortly after. Voice announcements began every minute, and a woman's voice, that of Ms. Jane Barbie, was used for the announcements. Also, the station began transmitting a digital time code for the first time when the telegraphic time code was discontinued. The station was now offering services nearly identical to those provided by WWV. In August 1991, both WWV and WWVH began broadcasting voice recordings that were digitized and stored in solid-state memory devices. The voice of Jane Barbie was still used for the announcements, but the digital storage device made her voice sound slightly different. Hurricanes have harmed WWVH on at least two occasions. In 1982, Kauai was struck by Hurricane Iwa, and the station remained on emergency power for 7 days. In 1992, Hurricane Iniki passed over the station, damaging the roof, interior, antennas, and fences, as well as cutting power and communications and blocking roads. For a few days, only the 5 megahertz transmitter remained on the air at half power, but other station services were quickly restored. Like WWV, WWVH has undergone a number of equipment and maintenance changes in recent years, but the broadcast format has remained essentially unchanged since 1991, when year information was added to the time code, and the daylight saving time notification in the time code was improved. The principal coverage area for WWVH is the parts of the United States not reliably covered by WWV, primarily the states of Hawaii and Alaska. Prior to the station's move to Kauai in 1971, a computer study was performed showing that the directional antennas of the station would project a cardioid pattern of radio illumination, which would cover Alaska to the north, New Zealand to the south, and reach the major cities of Saigon, Singapore, Hong Kong, and Calcutta. The study showed that WWVH signals would have reception reliability at these key cities of from 90 to 99% during the hours between 0600 and 1600 UTC, and only slightly less reliability during other hours. Like WWV, the station sends out QSL cards to confirm reception. WWVB began operation as radio station KK2XEI in July 1956. This experimental station was operated from 1530 to 2000 hours Universal Time each working day from Boulder, Colorado. The continuous wave 60 kilohertz signal was not modulated except for a call sign ID that was sent every 20 minutes. Subsequent experiments verified that a low-frequency transmission was far more stable than the signals from WWV and WWVH. The success of the 60 kHz broadcast led to the construction of a VLF, or very low frequency radio station, named WWVL, which began operation from Sunset, Colorado in April 1960, using a carrier frequency of 20 kHz. It was originally planned to use the 20 kHz for worldwide coverage and the 60 kHz broadcast for coverage of the United States. In March 1960, the call sign WWVB was obtained by NBS for the 60 kHz station. The B in the call sign probably stands for Boulder, the site of the original transmitter. However, one interesting theory is that the B could stand for Brown. W.W. Brown, one of the designers of the Fort Collins station, was employed as a contractor by NBS when the call sign application was submitted. Perhaps not coincidentally, his initials were WWB. In 1962, NBS began building a new facility on a site north of Fort Collins, Colorado, that would later also become the home of WWV. The site was attractive for several reasons, one being its exceptionally high ground conductivity, which was due to the high alkalinity of the soil. It was also reasonably close to Boulder, which made it easy to staff and manage, but much farther away from the mountains. The increased distance from the mountains made it a better choice for broadcasting an omnidirectional signal. WWVB went on the air on July 5, 1963, broadcasting a 5-kilowatt signal on 60 kilohertz. This was later increased to 7 kilowatts and then 13 kilowatts, where it remained until December 1997. WWVL began transmitting a 500-watt signal that was later increased to 2 kilowatts on 20 kilohertz. The following month. WWVL had a relatively short lifespan, going off the air in July 1972, but WWVB went on to become a permanent part of the nation's infrastructure. A time code was added to WWVB on July 1, 1965. This made it possible for radio clocks to be designed that could decode the signal, recover the time, and automatically set themselves. The WWVB broadcast continued operations up to the 1990s, with only minor modification to the format or equipment. The number of customers was relatively small, mostly calibration laboratories who operated WWVB-disciplined oscillators, devices that employed the 60 kHz carrier as a frequency reference. Also, the limitations of the aging transmitting equipment at WWVB became increasingly apparent as the years passed. The situation came to a head on February 7, 1994, when a heavy mist froze to the antenna, and the antenna tuning system could not compensate, shutting down the WWVB transmitters for about 30 hours. After reviewing the available options, it was decided that a redesign of the entire WWVB transmitting system would be necessary. During the design discussions, it was decided to substantially raise the power level of the broadcasts. It was obvious that WWVB could play a much larger role and reach far more customers if the signal were easier to receive in Europe. Low-cost radio control clocks were beginning to appear there, designed to synchronize to stations such as MSF in the United Kingdom and DCF-77 in Germany. These stations, by the way, were very similar to WWVB, but had a much smaller coverage area to service. As a result, European customers were able to purchase radio-controlled alarm clocks, wall clocks, and wristwatches at reasonable prices. These products lacked the external antennas and high sensitivity of the laboratory receivers, but would undoubtedly work well in the United States if the WWVB signals were made stronger. Expert consultants and engineers from the U.S. Navy were hired to evaluate the WWVB system and propose changes. Their reports suggested that although the antennas themselves were in reasonably good shape, the transmitters and matching equipment should be completely redesigned and new or upgraded equipment installed. A formal announcement that the WWVB power was to be increased was made during 1996, and a significant number of low-cost radio-controlled clock products were introduced in the United States shortly thereafter. By December 1997, an interim stage of the upgrade was completed, and the power was increased to about 25 kilowatts. By August 5, 1999, the upgrade was complete. The new WWVB configuration used two modern transmitters operating into two antennas that simultaneously broadcast the same 60 kHz signal. This increased their effective radiated power to 50 kilowatts, about four times more power than the pre-upgrade configuration. The increase in power greatly increased the coverage area, and low-cost radio-controlled clocks that synchronized to WWVB soon became commonplace throughout the United States. The mission of the NBS, now NIST radio stations, is to distribute NIST time of day, time interval, and standard frequency information to industry, government, and the general public. Other broadcast services operated by the NIST Time and Frequency Division include the Telephone Time of Day System, the Automated Computer Time Service, and the time.gov websites. The radio stations are each equipped with a set of three commercial cesium oscillators for frequency standards. WWV and WWVB share one set. They're connected to monitoring equipment that constantly compares their outputs and removes one from service automatically if it fails. The WWV and WWVH broadcast formats are very similar, as we noted. The most obvious difference to the listener is that the WWV voice time announcements are made using a male voice, and WWVH uses a female voice to avoid confusion between the two stations, since both can be received in some areas. A word about the WWV telephone time of day service. Since 1971, the WWV audio signal has been available on telephone by dialing 303-499-7111. At the station, the calls are sent to one of five commercial call screening units. These are normally found at offices or businesses to route callers to various extensions, and we sometimes refer to them as a phone tree. In that application, the caller would normally hear a pre-recorded greeting, followed by a list of options or extensions that could be accessed. After making a selection, the caller would hear music on hold until the extension was rung. However, in this application, no greeting is played, the caller is immediately placed on hold, and instead of music, the caller hears the audio signal from the on-air WWV timecode generator. The screening unit disconnects the call after a preset time, normally 3 minutes. The length of call can be shortened if necessary to accommodate more calls. At WWVH, the telephone time of day service was initiated in April 1973. A caller there dials 808-335-4363 and is connected to the WWVH audio signal. It's difficult to accurately estimate how many customers use the NIST time and frequency radio services, since after the signals leave, they can potentially be received by a nearly infinite number of receivers. NIST receives feedback from only a tiny fraction of these customers, so estimates of the number of receivers in use must be obtained from other sources. WWV and WWVH can potentially be received by anyone possessing a shortwave radio. It's estimated from surveys conducted by the Voice of America and the BBC that no more than 1% of the U.S. population listens to shortwave radio during a given week. While this means that the potential combined audience for the two stations is probably less than 3 million, this is still a very substantial figure. It is a safe assumption that most shortwave listeners are aware of the presence of WWV and or WWVH, since they are among the easiest shortwave stations to receive in the United States, and since they occupy easy-to-remember dial locations. Anyone with a shortwave radio is likely to stumble across one of the broadcasts. WWV and WWVH broadcast standard audio frequencies of 440, 500, and 600 Hz for use as a traceable calibration source. The 440 Hz is particularly noteworthy since it serves as the ultimate reference for the calibration of pianos and other musical instruments. Since 1939, A440, the musical note A above middle C, has been the internationally recognized standard for musical pitch. The piano tuner listens to a standard musical pitch and compares it to the same note on the piano keyboard. The piano then, of course, adjusted by tightening or loosening strings until it agrees with the audio standard. The actual piano tuning is generally done with a transfer standard, such as a tuning fork or an audio tone generator, since these devices are easy to bring to the piano site. However, the audio from WWV, WWVH is often used as the reference for calibrating this transfer standard. And so, dear listeners, that's some of the many uses for the precision frequency standards broadcast by the WWV family of stations. The next step in our research is to determine why those frequency references and time signals were so useful to broadcast stations. And that is the subject of a future column on this subject, and as well on Top of the Hour Time Tones. Meanwhile, hope you found this information useful and informative, or maybe just plain interesting. Mark Dernberger for the DX Audio Service. We hope to find you on this same precise frequency next month. Until then, good listening, DXers.
Thanks, Mark. A few bits of sad news with the passing of two longtime National Radio Club members. John Bryant, age 68, passed away on Tuesday, February the 9th at St. John Medical Center in Tulsa, Oklahoma, following a severe head injury sustained as the result of a fall from a ladder. John was born in 1941, April 30th, in Oklahoma City and grew up in the Stillwater area, graduating from Stillwater High School in 1959. He graduated from Oklahoma State University in 1964 with a bachelor's degree in architecture and earned a master's degree from the University of Illinois in 1968. Following his graduation, he was employed as a professional architect at the Benham Group in Oklahoma City, but his true passion was teaching, and in 1970 he was hired as a Regents Professor of Architecture at Auburn University, where he taught until 1976. In 1997, John was chosen as a Fellow of the American Institute of Architects. John not only loved to teach, but he loved to learn. His adolescent hobby of shortwave radio listening led to a lifetime of radio study and eventually expertise. John was internationally known as a radio antenna designer and tester. His standards were high, and he was never satisfied. John had a great interest in the history of radio as well. He co-authored four books on the history of the Zenith Radio Corporation with his dear friend Harold Cones. He and Harold also co-authored a book, Dangerous Crossings, an account of the first modern polar expedition in 1925, in which radios and airplanes were first used to the far north. From 1988 to 1992, John self-published six editions of Proceedings and compilations of articles written by shortwave radio enthusiasts sharing their expertise on the unusual and technically complicated hobby. And Kermit Geary, age 92, of Walnutport, passed away on February 10th. Born in Lehigh Gap, he was the son of the late Irwin and Carrie Geary. Kermit retired from the New Jersey Zinc Company as a research scientist. He was a member of the NRHS Lehigh Valley Chapter, Palmerton Camera Club, and of the National Radio Club DX Association, where he was the oldest living member. Kermit was an avid photographer with various contributions in books and magazines pertaining to railroads and local history. John Kellerman of Crum, Texas, had some words about Kermit's passing on the National Radio Club's listserv. He writes, "I, too, regret never meeting Kermit Geary. I had hoped that he'd be at the National Radio Club's Culpsville Convention back in 2004, but he was unable to make it. I was already set to visit an old friend in Texas after the gathering, so I couldn't make a side trip to his home." In 1962, the late Harold Schrock packaged 22 years of National Radio Club bulletins dating back to the 1940s and sent them to me when I was living in Monroe, Louisiana, and I actually read every musing from 1940 on, including many from Kermit. I'm surprised that Pete Taylor did not make reference to the reception report Kermit sent us in 1967 when we did a DX test after switching WXHR 740 to WCAS. Kermit had all the program details, but he couched them with a satirical form, as if the program was filled with messages to the insurrectionists who were fighting for the independence of Wickes Island. That's what we called the five suburbs, of which we were providing intensive local news and talk programming. Watertown, Cambridge, Arlington, Somerville, and, Belmont. My very favorite people are those that can write clever satirical material, and Kermit moved way up after we received that reception report. Although I wasn't involved in the work done to build the marvelous National Radio Club 50th Anniversary book, I knew that those who did put it together were greatly supportive of Kermit, who provided copies and many pages of the earliest club bulletins. He was one of the all-time great broadcast band DXers. When you talk about somebody who doesn't like digital radio, IBOC in specific, the first name that comes to mind is Leonard Kahn, the father of AM stereo radio. Well, Leonard has entered a new phase in life. He's now an author, having just put down a book called Procee, A Fool for a Client, The True Story You Will Never Believe by Leonard R. Kahn. It's in paperback, published November 21st of 2009. You can buy it new on Amazon for $15.50. Its title ID is 3410731. And there's also talk that Leonard might make a run for the Senate in the state of Florida, so we'll just have to follow this story a little more carefully.
At this time, please turn over your tape to side two.
I've got sunshine on a cloudy day. When it's cold outside, I've got the month of May. I guess you'll say, what can make me feel this way, my girl,
my girl,
my girl,
talking about my girl,
my girl.
I've got so much honey, the bees envy me. I've got a sweeter song than the birds in the trees. Well, I guess you'll say, what can make me feel this way, my girl,
my girl,
my girl,
talking about my girl,